CJSF 90.1 FM Radio Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
Events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be sharing his insights into how recent travel restrictions might impact disability employment. So with all the recent travel restrictions and complications, what's the potential impact on disability employment opportunities?
Well, I think across North America, and I think, you know, we sort of, as people who live in North America, we worry sort of what's going on our continent. Folks are not only are they not traveling to the U.S., but job opportunities are slipping away. This idea that DEI, diversity, equity, or inclusion are things that we have to get rid of really goes to the root cause of where we started this fight so many years ago, that people present are equal, that they are valued for what they bring to the table. This really sort of speaks to the idea that there is one section of the population that's better than somebody else. And it's a ongoing concern that I think many folks have. And it's not only for folks with disabilities. It's anyone who's in a minority. DEI isn't just about disability. It's about inclusive societies that we are supposed to be building, where folks can be themselves and be appreciated for that. Nobody's asking for anybody to, you know, if you don't agree with something, well, that's fine. That's okay. But there are implications for that. And what we've always found, Ken, and I mean, you as well as anybody else know, that 1 in 10 acquire a disability over their lifetime. Many people will have somebody in their family acquire a disability. And I always like this statement, it shouldn't matter to you for it to matter. And that's one of the things that I talk about with DEI, is that it should matter to everybody else, but even if it's not in your radar, you know people it's affecting. And I hope that the people in our lives are not the people who are trying to keep us down, that they believe in our abilities or our ability to contribute and be included. And that's where we really want this critical change. We want people to start standing up and saying, not my son, not my daughter, not my sister, not my cousin. Because that's where real change begins, when somebody who may be not directly affected by something says, excuse me, that's not the right way to do this. And when we start to have those conversations a little more, I hope we can get back on the path where DEI becomes something that we celebrate, and that the differences that we bring to the table are ones that make us evolve.
So it's interesting you mentioned about diversity in particular. I hear it a lot and don't always hear disability factor into the equation. I mean, everyone talks about this group or that group, but you don't always hear people thinking about diversity in terms of including folks with disabilities. Any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that we as a community, and I use that term broadly, we have to start talking about the things that it really does include. People wouldn't say that diversity would include seniors, but it does. People would say that, you know, equity and inclusion give people an advantage. Well, actually, it doesn't. What these three words are actually about are removing the barriers that we or cisgendered or other folks don't face. This isn't about, it isn't pie, right? I mean, this is great meme of, you know, somebody's rights and ability aren't divided up and somebody gets more, you get less. This is about recognizing and identifying that people who look different, act different, talk different, celebrate differently, will be looked upon by the majority as different and often less valuable because they don't look like them. Now, Cam, the funny thing about all of this is very often the discrimination that folks face, any marginalized group, aren't coming from that community. It's the misunderstanding that everybody else has. So folks who live in marginalized community, whether that be folks with disabilities or racialized new immigrants, they all face the same issue. They're comfortable with who they are. The challenge is everybody else. So it comes down to a lot of the things that I've learned. It's people are unsure, uncomfortable. How do I work with somebody who's a different religion? How do I talk to somebody who is in a wheelchair? So it really comes down to some early education where folks in wheelchairs talk like just everybody else. People who come from other countries to help us support our economy and fill labor market need, because there is still this labor market need, they have disabilities as well. So it's the understanding that the contribution is equal. And if you do look different than everybody else, you will have barriers. And that's what we're trying to remove. It's not giving somebody an opportunity they don't deserve. It's giving them the opportunity that everybody else had, but they did not get because of barriers. Whether that be physical barriers to the workplace, educational, social barriers, what community you came from, where you live now. It's one of those things that we, in certain areas of the country, we see the ghettoization of communities, whether that be low-income, LGBTQ, any of the minorities in Toronto, they congregated together. Some of that is dying away, so, whether it's Little Italy or Little Greek, those areas still have a great pronunciation of those particular communities, but we're starting to see a little bit of a gentrification where people are starting to feel somewhat more comfortable across the spectrum. So if you were a immigrant, you wouldn't always have to live in a community that was predominantly from where you lived. And that's a generational benefit, I think, that we're still experiencing, and we need to support. We shouldn't ghettoize anybody. People should be supported to live across the community. And just because you're one particular disability or ethnicity or religion, it doesn't mean that other communities can't be enriched by your presence.
That's interesting in so much as I've always found that when people really spend some time together, get to know each other, you might find their cultural practice, their disability, appliances, what have you, they don't make all that much difference. You get to know them as a person and form a deep understanding by working alongside them, by having just common experiences.
Yeah, folks just want to live their lives to the best of their ability without somebody else defining limitations or what they can do. It's a dream for many people just to be included and have conversations that are often irrelevant. It's not about the disability. It's not about the hardware. It's not about the community. It's about them as individuals. The idea that somehow we separate people out into color, size, shape, gender, it's just ways that we're trying to understand our world when really what we should be doing is looking at people as they are, human beings. They have the same wants and needs and fears. And when you come from a developed country or if you come from a country that's still developing, you have different ideas and expectations. But what we should be trying to accomplish is for everybody to feel that they have something to give. The communities that we live in are more fractured. They seem more confrontational. They're siloed. And at the end of the day, we all want the same thing, a better community, a better job, a better life. So when we talk about what is it that makes people uncomfortable, it's that we're all going in the same direction, but some people sometimes think that they need to be on a different path. And at the end of the day, because we're all going in the same direction, we should be all on the same path.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us an update on Thrive. So with the recent Paralympics, what do you think the impact will be on the disability athletic community?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, to take it back when I competed in the late 80s and early 90s, no one really knew about the Paralympics. That's different now. The coverage was remarkable. And it was great to see so many former athletes being hosts or play-by-play commentators, color analysts. So it really, you know, works with that nothing about us or for us without us. That was terrific. It's got to lend to more interest in participation, and certainly that's where it starts for the parasport, the Paralympic pyramid, you might say. I mean, we're looking at when we're watching the Paralympics. That's the pinnacle. That's the peak. But it needs a base, and I think it's certainly going to increase that base.
So, as you and I both know so well, disability sport is something that goes on every night of the week, and there's always training, there's always events. Do you have any advice for folks out there to sort of keep the momentum going to find out more about what's going on in the sport community?
You know, I find you're absolutely right that there are opportunities. Problem is, people don't know about them. And me being in the media business like you, and marketing and sales and promotion, you know, the old adage about if you build it, they will come. I don't really believe that when it comes to parasport and adaptive recreation. You got to tell people about it. And, you know, the signs in the window are, I think, the next step here to really promote those opportunities so people know about them. Networking is important, too. So often parents in the bleachers are at you know, adaptive sporting events are sharing about other opportunities. That's important. But, yeah, promoting the fact that these inclusive opportunities exist, I think, is a key next step for participation, building participation.
I always find it ironic that you see a traditional sports page or sports broadcast. You never see the para side of things in so much as these athletes, they train just as hard, if not harder. They still put on one heck of an athletic performance, in my opinion. So,
yeah, I mean, what hasn't changed since the time that I was a Paralympic athlete is the fact that we want to be recognized as that, simply, as athletes. But there's always the backstory, you know, who lost his leg in a, you know, fill-in-the-blank accident, or who was paralyzed this way or became blind at this point. So it's that side story that I think we're getting away from more so. But for me, it's just too tempting to not tell that story. And it is part of our identity for sure. But that narrative of, you know, achieving at the highest sporting level, athletic level, despite being an amputee or overcoming, that's still a narrative that needs a little bit of polish and working on.
And not everything in the disabilities world is meant to be inspirational. I mean, someone with a disability gets up and makes breakfast. That's not per se inspirational. That's called eating. And for these athletes, they're just doing what they love, I think. I mean, they want to be part of the game, so they push themselves, they train themselves, and hopefully they get there.
Yeah, I mean, sticking with the narrative, it's like you say, it's just called eating, or it's called grocery shopping, or it's called walking the dog. It's that is not the ceiling of you know, our abilities or you know, aspirations for ourselves. I think in many cases, looking at those athletic, watching those athletic achievements, I mean, the wheelchair curling team, my goodness, there was nothing short of inspirational as athletes and what they accomplished. And that's no different for the Olympics or the Paralympics. So there's a time and place for inspiration, kind of an appropriate or not patronizing, might be a way of putting it.
That being said, with the recent push in recognition for the Paralympics, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
You know, I guess coming back to where I started in terms of television coverage and the fact that it is accessible for the general population to consume. And I did see some statistics about how many, I guess, games recognition or awareness, you know, surveys that have been done in the general population of, you know, do you know what the Paralympics are? Are you a fan of the Paralympics? And the percentages that I read are really encouraging. Something like 70% of the country knows about the Paralympics, and just short of that, we're fans of it. So, yeah, that's a huge step for, I think, valuing the product, that being Paralympics, for what it is, the pinnacle of athletic achievement from our disability community. So that's a huge growth. I mean, so much advertising as well was specific to Paralympics during the games, and that was cool to see too.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Cam.
Of course. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So, you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making a cocktail and having fun. Even when with friends, it's important to remember alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks can save a life. Then, you can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Safe.
Welcome back to Andy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Sean Wiltshire gave us an update on the disability employment situation, and we heard a little bit about recent Paralympic coverage from Jeff Thiessen.
In this segment of our show, Mateo Legg will be telling us a little bit about his disability journey. So what can you tell me about your disability story?
So, I was involved in a serious motorcycle accident. So that was in August 12th, 2021. I was involved in the accident, and it was very serious. It was in Brampton, Ontario, and it was single vehicle, so it was just myself and that's it. And I got airlifted, essentially, near complete amputation of my left leg, right shoulder, and both arms broken. And it happened in the middle of the night with a bunch of friends, went out for riding, got airlifted, and next thing you know, it just started off as a normal drive ride with the boys, and woke up 3 weeks, 2 weeks later out of a coma, and my life changed. It was completely different to what I was used to, and that's how my journey started.
So, when you woke up and you found the world had changed for you, what sort of coping strategies did you use to deal with your new normal?
Well, at first, I guess I went through stages of grief, I'd say, because there's the moment when you wake up and you come to realization of what had happened to you, and then there's also the later effect of starting the transition of living that new life and everything like that. So there was different stages of coping with it, I guess I'd say. The first stage when I woke up and I realized my life was different was a complete shock, but I had a strong support of friends and a lot of medical attention, doctors, and there was a lot of confusion of what's going to happen because, as you know, they tell you one thing at the hospital, doctor, everyone has their own opinion. Even though they have their specialties, not all their opinions are accurate or correct. But you take it into account that this, what they're telling you, the information, this is how you're going to live your new life. So it was a pretty big shock for me at first. And I really had to learn how to just cope and deal with it and communicate and talk to my loved ones, and that's when you really see who's there for you and your circle of friends. But I think the biggest struggle I had was when I got home and a couple months passed. I was in the hospital for 3 months, had 17, 18 surgeries. I was in Sunnybrook first, then I got transferred to Brampton. Once I got home and a couple months passed, so I was in the hospital for 3 months, I got home. Once the actual journey of road to recovery, I guess we'd say, started, that's when I really started to deal with mental problems and just dealing with mental health issues and depression, and everything caught up to me because, like I said, you have a strong support of friends and everything, but I guess people move on with life, and not necessarily saying they moved on from me, but there's obligations, and I understand that too, and people have work and their own life and their own problems, and that's when I realized it was just me, my brother, my mom, and my dad, and that's that.
So, those moments where you were facing depression and mental health struggles, what techniques did you use to keep yourself strong and to say, I need to find a way to keep on living?
Well, during those moments, I watched a lot of podcasts, and I also listened to motivation videos online, and I kept trying to kind of uplift myself throughout the journey, but I guess it was helping in a certain way, but it also kind of wasn't. And it felt more like a placebo rather than actually being more motivated and more uplifted and trying to pull myself out of depression. The realization and helping myself get out of depression and that struggle really came to the realization of I need to stop running from my thoughts, and I need to stop running from my just thoughts and fears and all my problems, because my whole life, I guess, I've just had an escape. I was a very active kid. I rode BMX professionally, and I was always outside of the house and active and met up with a bunch of people and social. And now I'm in a wheelchair bound at home waiting for physio to come, and I don't have that escape to run to anymore. I can't go to the gym, go for a swim, run. And I realized once I can't outrun my thoughts, that is an issue. So I had to sit down and think, why am I running from my thoughts? I need to face my problems. And I sat down and started thinking, what are my problems? My problems are my disability of not being able to run, walk, and just the whole coping mechanism of leaving the house as well. I didn't want to leave the house. I had a fear of I'm in a wheelchair and my dad's pushing me around the mall. I didn't like people to look at me, and it kind of, I was sheltered in my living room, which was not good. You need to be exposed to outside the real world, the new people, new faces. And just getting that courage of stop running from my fears and going out and putting myself in an uncomfortable position, as I always have in life, just now it's a little bit of a different situation, I think exposed me to kind of not be so trapped mentally.
So, in your recovery journey, has there been any success moment you'd like to share?
There has been huge success moments. And from the beginning of being able to stand on my own 2 feet, because like I said, I was near amputation, but I wasn't complete amputation. So my leg was just held on by the main artery. So the doctor said I would never be able to walk again. I would never be able to stand again. I would be able to walk, but they said it would be a very long journey. And I remember when I woke up from the hospital in a coma, I was like really stressed. What's going on? This, that, shocked. My mom said, don't worry, everything's fine. You're going to be riding your bike again and all this stuff, just to kind of uplift me, even if she didn't know it was true or not true. And the doctor looked at us and said, ride a bike. He'll be lucky if he even walks again. And that was a really big shock. So I used that as part of motivation. But to answer your question about success during the journey, yes, I had success. I was able to, from standing up for the first time, that was a big success, I remember, in my living room, to starting to walk slowly with the help of a walker and people holding me. That was also a big success. My right arm was near complete amputation as well. So it was left leg, right arm. And I essentially cut all the nerves under my armpit. So those are the essential nerves to be able to move your arm. They said I'd have 20% after physio. Now I have 100% of my right arm. I can do monkey bars, climb them, and with my leg now I'm riding bikes, active, running, swimming. I can't bend it to the level that I was before. I still have pain. I still feel the change in weather. I still, my foot is still numb. But that's my new body, and I've learned to accept it and work with what I got. So there was lots of success, and I think my most important success story was that I'd like to share with you is, and with everyone, is I, like I said, rode BMX professionally. I used to do backflips on my bike and travel and compete, and my biggest goal was to ride my bike again. And that felt like an impossible challenge, what everybody said, from doctor to people, just comments, why do you want to ride bikes again? It's dangerous. Just kind of demotivating me instead of uplifting me. But I guess I understand from their perspective it's a dangerous sport, but it wasn't their decision ultimately, it was my decision. But I kept that fire and fuel inside me throughout physio, and I decided that I'm going to do a backflip once again on my bike, which sounds insane and it sounds completely unrealistic. And at the time, even when I said it, even I thought it was unrealistic. But I said, step by step, I read a quote, Rome wasn't built in a day, which is correct. So I said, step by step, long journey, and we're going to see what happens. And after years of physio, I kept going at it, I did physio in Europe, did physio in Canada. I even remember my physiotherapist here in Serbia, in Europe. I told him, what do you think about the idea of me doing a backflip again? He said, he just took a deep breath in, and he's, because this, we were already working together for 3 months at this point. He took a deep breath in and said, I don't recommend it from a medical standpoint at all, but I know you're not going to listen, so let's prepare that leg for your backflip. And we just laughed it off, and I sent him a video 3 months later, and I did a backflip. And I just did one just to finish it, and just so that I could have it under my belt, and that's it. But that was one of my biggest and proudest moments of my success journey.
Mike, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes.
My friends, I'm just going to come out and say it. I love Mateo's story. Here we have a man who was told, you'll never do this, you'll never do that. He chose to do what so many people with disabilities should do. Take it for what it is, an opinion. Take it with a grain of salt. He decided to do what he wanted to do on his own terms. And that is the way any one of us should live our lives. Maybe you'll encounter obstacles along the way. Maybe you won't. The point is, you grow stronger with each attempt. You grow stronger by choosing to say, I'm going to explore my own possibilities before I declare it impossible. Too many of us live by the glass ceiling. Too many of us allow others to dictate who we are and what we're going to be. One of the best pieces of advice I was ever given was by a professor of mine when I was in college. He said to me, do what is you, not what everyone else thinks you should be doing. And above all, in the disability community, it's okay if the boat gets rocked every once in a while. There are going to be people who just doubt your abilities simply because they like to cast gloom and shadows over things. But it's up to you to define your path. It's up to you to explore what you're capable of. It's no one's place to write it in rock for you. Honestly, you can set your mind on whatever goal you like and take whatever steps are within your capability to explore it. And that is your perfect right, whether you have a disability or not. It is no one's place to tell you who you are and what you should be. This has been AndyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Cheese please, you're so fine.
You wanna listen all the time. Snarf, Dude, and Gaffer gonna spin their hits. It's all cheesy music, they love it to bits. Well, Snarf, Dude is the man in the band.
fine, and cheesy music is his only plan. Daffodil is sugar, but she's also spice. She might be saucy, but she can be pretty nice. All the cheesy music and